being programmed to chill. A show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica. With your host, Jimmy Fallon Gong.
All right. Now we are back in the recording studio. Back with CJ. We're going to continue our conversation on State of Siege. And CJ has some words for us as we get started.
I do. I am always talking about, you know, holding myself accountable. We all must, you know, we have to call ourselves in and we have to, you know, be the best version of ourselves possible. I made a joke in poor taste at Jimmy's expense months and months and months ago. I believe that I referred to you lovingly as a weeb for Latin America. I am, at this rate, myself becoming a weeb for Latin America. I'm here to apologize. It is the greatest region, continent, what, you know, I mean, South America, but it is the best. I was wrong to poke fun. I have Duolingo and I'm learning Spanish.
Oh, yeah.
I am 360 pages into 2666. I can't stop. So, Jimmy, I'm sorry on behalf of past me.
It's okay.
I didn't know the error of my ways at the time.
Basically, Latin culture, it's a shining beacon in this world. And I don't consider myself a weeb. I consider myself a man of culture. So I welcome you in the spirit of amistad.
I don't know what that word means yet, but I'll get there. Duolingo will teach me eventually.
For those of you out there, CJ asked how to learn Spanish, because I learned Spanish, and so you wanted to know the methods by which I learned Spanish. And I don't think it's that helpful, actually, because I pretty much have two or three things I did. A, I did nothing for 2 years except learn Spanish. B, I would drink hot sauce every day, about a shot glass, right before you start, you know, with your grammar and your flashcards and so forth.
Wait, are you being serious?
Only a little bit.
Okay, that's right.
The third thing I did, of course, was, listeners, this will work for you too, any language. You get the Book of Mormon in English. You get the Book of Mormon in whatever language you want to learn. Sure, maybe it could work for another book, but I'm just saying, that's what I did. That's how I learned Spanish, so.
I was thinking about getting a Spanish copy of 2666 when I finished this and just starting over and doing the side-by-side like you suggested, because it's a great book, and I don't know. It seems like it would work, you know.
You'd probably hurt your wrists a little bit. Like, that's the thing. It does need to be a little bit, like, holdable size.
That's true. It could be a good workout for my forearms,
though. Maybe a different Bologna, perhaps.
By night in Chile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, you have to factor in, like, okay, what kind of words do I actually want to learn? Because let me tell you, I know a lot of ways to say archaic Spanish religious phrases, and that did not prove as useful, perhaps, as it could have been. So just keep that in mind.
Although if you ever wanted to, I mean, you would never do this on account of, you know, being a man of God, but if you wanted to, like, start some kind of cult in South or Central America, you are prepped. You could go on the diatribes.
I suppose, like, perhaps a certain Jim Jones over here. That's good. The levity is good, because we're otherwise about to talk about some heinous and dark shit. Speaking of, then, CJ and I, of course, we were, where we left off, we were going to get into death squads. What are they? Things of this nature. So maybe just by way of, like, introducing the topic, like, what did you think death squads were, CJ? And I can also jump in.
Yeah, so my understanding of death squads until fairly recently was, like, I guess kind of like right-wing guerrilla warfare, but, like, maybe like 10 degrees worse. So, like, I guess, like, thinking about maybe like terrorist attacks with, like, very little regard for civilian casualties, but targeted at, you know, left-wing leaders or, you know, like that sort of thing. Like, I guess my understanding of death squads was what people accuse left-wing guerrillas of being. And my, if that makes sense, it was like, no, that's actually what the right does. And then the left is more, you know, considered and measured in its tactics. That was my understanding of death squads. What was yours?
Yeah, no, I mean, I didn't really know. I remember mainly after, you know, my Mormon mission, basically reading a bunch of history and just encountering the phrase over and over. And, you know, initially in Guatemala, but, you know, I was just, I knew that they had them all over, largely in Latin America. And like, it took a surprising amount of time for me to kind of come around to an understanding, because like, I do get what you're saying, where you kind of thought that it was like guerrillas up in the mountains somewhere, they've got a base or something, when in reality, what we're really talking about is barely concealed, anonymous, like cops and military, mostly those two, moonlighting, just like killing people or blowing people up as a natural extension of their day jobs. That's like the majority of death squads.
Yeah. I think the thing that for me helped me kind of like wrap my head around, because it like it's so like putrid that like it like defied, like it was hard for me to like believe what was going on. But like I think I had to decontextualize it as like it's cops, it's people in the military, but it is not what you would recognize as like traditional military, or it's not related to like the actions of a military or policing as they are like traditionally understood.
As traditionally understood, yeah.
Yeah, it's the shit of nightmares. I mean, I think it's better to compare it to like serial killing.
And yeah, and in fact, there are some very deep comparisons to be made, particularly like in Northern Ireland with the Shankill Butchers, who were very much like serial killers doing it like in a like paramilitary like death squad situation. But then clearly they like did some that were not even ordered, and like some were just for pleasure. Like these things do start to bleed together in really disconcerting ways.
Right. Which then also it, I think that helped kind of situate some of what McGowan's talking about with stuff in like Vietnam and in the, you know, Korea and just Southeast Asia in general, where, you know, you have, you know, Phoenix folks. Again, it's like it makes a lot more sense with death squads as serial killers than it does as death squads as like just, you know, extra mean soldiers, you know, like, do you think now would be a good time to read the Bolaño passage? Cause I think it kind of,
I think
it
so.
More, like kind of clicked it for me. So by way of introduction, this is from, Nazi Literature in the Americas, which is an excellent, I mean, I know you've read it, but I'm going to try to sell it to your audience.
Oh yeah.
It's very, very funny until the end. And it's also, most of the chapters are like 5 to 10 pages long, and each chapter is like self-contained. It's like, it's a made up biography of all these far right authors and poets and critics.
Like a faux encyclopedia.
Right. They co-mingle with like real history and real historical figures and stuff, but the people themselves are made up. And so if your attention span is just rotten, it's really easy, because every couple pages you start reading about someone new with their own quirks and idiosyncrasies. And Bolaño really understands that, you know, right-wing culture is just riddled with freaks and weirdos and sickos and, you know, perverts. Like, that's the whole book.
Yeah, I really love how he really takes them seriously, but also holds them as contemptible, hilarious losers. Both, like, both are true because they are true.
Right, exactly. And I think, like, I guess this is a light spoiler, but the so I mentioned it's funny, and it is. It's very funny up until the last chapter, which is called The Infamous Ramirez Hoffman, which I believe he went on to turn into a novella. Do you know?
Yeah, no, I think that might be By Night in Chile. So I think the same like fundamental story is told in both, if
Okay.
memory serves.
And so this story is not funny. There's not a gag in the whole thing. It's the longest too. It's probably 30 pages long. But basically, Ramirez Hoffman is a he's a death squad member. He works for the military in Chile, I believe, during and after the coup. Correct me if I'm saying anything wrong. I should have rewritten
Yeah.
this. I didn't. The narrator of this part of the book is,
Wait, was he the fighter pilot?
yeah.
Okay, I think that's Distant Star, not By Night in Chile, my bad.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but it's like the same nugget of the story, and he builds it up. Yeah.
But so anyway, so this it's the biography of this guy. And he, long story short, there's these two young women whose parents are lefty artists. The parents have been disappeared already, and these are their teenage daughters. They go to stay with their aunt out in the country, outside of whatever city they're in, basically to hide, right?
Because this is in the wake of the coup, right, in Chile.
So, yeah, the week after the coup, it says. So they leave their apartment and they go out to the country to stay with their aunt. I guess the parents were already dead. But anyway, so these are literal teenage girls, and they're one of them is like dating slash like hooking up with Ramirez Hoffman, right? They think of him as like their college buddy. He's just like a He's a little bit on the right, but like he's a student, he's a poet, just like them. You know, what again? I mean, I like him enough to sleep with them, so there's that. But then, so he shows up, so that they tell him, hey, you know, we're here at our aunt's. You should come hang out with us. So, paraphrasing, they that he shows up, he drinks wine with them with them he they're reading poetry together with the aunt. He's a house guest, right? And then let's see, and then it goes like this. So he's reading poetry with them, leads to this. And during the night, oh, they don't even know, sorry, they don't know his real name. His name, they know him as Emilio Stevens, but his name is Ramirez Hoffman. And during the night, Emilio Stevens gets up like a sleepwalker. Perhaps he has slept with Maria Venegas. Maria's one of the sisters. Perhaps not. At any rate, he gets up without hesitation, like a sleepwalker, and goes to the aunt's room, hearing the motor of a car approaching the house. And then he cuts the aunt's throat. No, he stabs her in the heart. It's cleaner, quicker. He covers her mouth and plunges the knife into her heart. Then he goes down and opens the door, and two men come into the house that belongs to the stars of one chariot. Chernyakovsky's poetry workshop, and the fucked up night comes into the house, and then it goes out again. Almost straight away, the night comes in, and out it goes, swift and efficient. And the bodies vanish, but no, years later, one will appear in a mass grave, that of Magdalena Venegas, but only hers, as if to prove that Ramirez Hoffman is a man and not a god. So he literally, like, I mean, that, and that's what death squads are. It's somebody that you trust and know as a friend, letting murders into your house and killing your family after your fucking parents have already been killed. Like, I don't know. I don't know if that's super relevant, but to me, that was very, like, that really sold me and helped me understand what we were talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just, I mean, we talked about how like by and large, a significant portion of them are just cops and soldiers on special assignments, frequently, not always, but frequently working under direct like supervision of the state. I mean, they make it into like the deniable zone, but like
right,
more or less controlled. And often there might be some like criminal elements brought in as well, but like, again, typically acting under someone's orders, and very often also carrying out false flag attacks. That's another thing they did or do, you know, do. So very, very interesting. They always have the fucking worst names too, like the Black Hands, the White Hands, like something stupid like that. The Los Novios de Muerte, the Fiancés of Death.
Oh, that sucks.
Horrible, horrible
That's
stuff.
That's so lame.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think it's important to emphasize that this is not, this has nothing to do with combat. Like it's to demoralize and destabilize like the entire population. And you know, say what you will about McGowan, like if whether you believe like in some of his theses that he draws in Program to Chill, but like or program, sorry, Program to Kill. But I mean, this stuff is documented and verified. Like this happened for decades.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So many Truth and Reconciliation commissions have like laid it all out. Like, it's not disputable.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and it, like, I mean, in Operation Condor, like, they just found a whole bunch of new documents about that, like, within the last 20 years, like, less, I think it's 2008-ish, maybe, like, the late aughts. I could be getting the date wrong, but it's like, and it was like still a, like a hot topic in the, as it should be, but it's like, this isn't, you know, left behind. This is, you know, relevant up to today.
Yeah. And like, what's crazy too, is that like, this isn't like fringe or like weird or like parapolitical or even just like political history in Latin America. This is like shit people know about. They talk about it.
Oh yeah. Right.
It's just us Americans that have to like somehow like fight a battle just to like acknowledge the reality of things that happened back during the Cold War. Well, and honestly, it still go on, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, well, cause I mean, how would you, how, if you knew people who were disappeared, right. Or you knew people who, you know, were like, yeah, someone killed my brother. They just like, and they hung his body outside. It's like, you can't, we're insulated here in the Imperial Corps or whatever. Like, we don't have to see it, but it's, I mean, it's just daily business elsewhere.
Let me ask you this, like growing up, because this, you know, maybe I'm betraying my own thoughts growing up, but like, you know how like, if you just like take Batman seriously, but then like, obviously there's the Punisher. And so it's like, maybe you get a little bit older and you're not as interested in Batman and you start thinking about how cool would it be? Like, why is there a mafia? Why isn't there just a special ops military guy who just goes and kills the mafia? You know, like that was like the most of the Punisher's like plot right. lines. And then you'd like, or like the movie Death Wish, you know, or a million different pieces of media that entertain these like fascist fantasies of like cleaning up the streets or whatever the fuck.
Dirty Harry, Taxi Driver. I mean, Taxi Driver is more critical, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, when I was a certain age, those stories were very appealing to me, like Rorschach, right? And the Watchmen. And, you know, obviously it's sick and diseased, but like it's normal to a certain extent, I think, at least in this media environment. And it took me learning a shit ton of Latin American history to like come to realize how insanely fucked up that is. You know?
Yeah.
Because A, they don't act like those movies. It's never real. It's never like, oh, we're going to take out the mafia by just killing the mafia members. It's always like, we're going after a fucking trade unionist. And by way of getting at him, we're going to like kidnap his brother or something. Like, it's
right.
It's never actually what they, you know, depict.
Right. Well, I mean, I think it's because things like Batman or Punisher. I mean, I would have to reread Watchmen. I imagine this is less the case in Watchmen, but
It's kind of like a Taxi Driver thing where he kind of undermines it.
yeah, right. But no, where I mean, Batman and Punisher aren't the world that they're operating in isn't governed by the same power structures and rules that, you know, apply it to our world, right? Like, because yeah, I mean, the death squads wouldn't go after the mafia. Like that's the you know what I mean? Like the paramilitary, what's the word for the vigilante, quote unquote, is never going to go after the mafia in our world. Isn't like he in fact he probably has ties to organized crime and is going after the enemies of organized crime and their handlers, which is capital. And that's like trade unionists, organizers, you know, radical politicians, you know, to the degree that they exist, which is more down, you know, outside of America. But yeah.
Yeah, 'cause like the example of like a death squad that isn't directly controlled by the state would be like basically in like Colombia where like a plantation owner has a gang of thugs
Right.
to rough up people or kill them or disappear them. Like that is the main other version of death squads that isn't just like a special unit of the military that does it.
Right. But yeah, no, I think that it's I mean, I know you've said this on the show numerous times, but really looking at Latin American history and politics is super, super illustrative, is that the word? For how, you know, power works, for how capital, you know, exploits and maintains its control of places. And then for, you know, also stories of very powerful and as effective resistances as may be possible against that sort of stuff. But it's all there.
No, it is very interesting. And then it's always interesting to compare and contrast how it's like that in the US, but different because there's very much like a certain vibe that like those types of groups can't operate. Instead, they just have like the police do it,
Right. Well, I mean,
basically.
we were talking about this. I was just in Chicago, and I was thinking about, was it like 2015, maybe, where there was the black sites that were, you know, and it's like,
Homan Square or whatever, something like that.
yeah, right. And then like that's just the Chicago police. Like that's, you know, doing this. And again, it's not like identical, but it is very comparable, and it serves a similar role.
Yeah, they can't do quite as much, quite as openly, but like it's not as bad here, but it's not like there are like countervailing like
Right.
elements. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Well, yeah, and I mean it's what's the who I don't remember who talks about it, but like the I mean I guess Pynchon kind of does, where the things that are worked on and perfected in the colonies are then brought back to the imperial core. Like, you know, it's you work the technologies out there, and then you just once you got it tightened up and perfected, you just bring it back, you know. I
Yeah,
mean, that's
they're
why we.
always doing that. Like, there's shit that they developed in the Spanish-American War that got brought back here. There's shit from Korea and Vietnam. You know, like,
Right.
it's like a churning thing.
And now they send cops from, you know, cities and municipalities over to Israel to train with the IDF and come. And it's like, it's just, yeah, it's just the cycle. It never stops.
So let's return to the Uruguayan situation. We talked about how Dan Mitrione was setting up essentially both the torture and the death squads in Brazil. When he and his agency, the OPS, they basically set up a death squad in Uruguay. And again, I'm quoting from the book Killing Hope by Blum. And he wrote, composed, as elsewhere in Latin America, primarily of police officers who bombed and strafed the homes of suspected Tupamaro sympathizers and engaged in assassination and kidnapping. The death squads received some of its special explosive material from the Technical Services Division of the CIA. And in all likelihood, some of the skills employed by its members were acquired from instruction in the United States. Between 1969 and 1973, at least 16 Uruguayan police officers went through an 8-week course at CIA OPS schools in Washington, D.C. and Los Fresnos, Texas, in the design, manufacture, and employment of bombs and incendiary devices. The official OPS explanation for these courses was that policemen needed such training in order to deal with the bombs placed by terrorists. There was, however, no instruction in destroying bombs, only in making them. Moreover, on at least one reported occasion, the students were not policemen, but members of a private right-wing organization in Chile. Another part of the curriculum, which might have proven of value to the death squad, was the class on assassination weapons, and I quote, a discussion of various weapons which may be used by the assassin, unquote, is how OPS put it, unquote. Now, we talked about this. They actually show this in the movie, State of Siege, them blowing up shit in the desert in what looks to be Texas, basically.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's like all offensive, like not even, like couldn't even really claim that this was like a bomb squad, you know, thing.
Right. It's years of lead shit blowing up train stations.
Yeah, exactly. So the New York Times reporter Langoth, he reported that the CIA ran the camp at Los Fresnos, Texas. And yeah, like it was entirely offensive, as Bloom also reported. Now, Mitrione specifically selected 7 Uruguayan police to take this course. He also introduced members of Brazil's police death squads to the Uruguayan death squad embedded within the police. Basically, like making Condor happen by being the guy introducing people. Of course, Condor had like many higher up guys than just Mitrione making that happen, but still.
Right. But I mean, he was directly facilitating the.
So, by the way, I think I sent you the one of the articles that talked all about Los Fresnos, and it is just the wildest shit. I did want to point out Los Fresnos is a small town in part of the Brownsville, Matamoros metropolitan area. You know, Matamoros, which might ring a bell for a few satanic cults that were active at the time. Just throwing that out there. Now, the article I sent you, CJ, right, it was entitled Secret U.S. Bomb School Exposed Police Terrorism in Latin America, and it was written by Michael Clare and Nancy Stein, and it lists out a long list of countries which received this specific bomb training, and at the top of the list by number of people sent to the training is Colombia, Guatemala, Uruguay, and Thailand, all of which were either dictatorships in like officially or might as well have been.
Right. Yeah. Functionally.
The article really just pulls no punches, and I quote from it. Indeed, there is mounting evidence that some third world policemen, particularly in Latin America, are themselves engaged in terrorist activities, utilizing their U.S. supplied training in vigilante assassination teams like La Mano Blanca, White Hand, and Ojo por Ojo, or Eye for an Eye, in Guatemala, La Banda in the Dominican Republic, and death squads in Brazil and Uruguay. It is generally acknowledged that the death squads are made up of off-duty policemen and representatives of the civil and military intelligence services. And then it quotes from Sao Paulo's top criminal judge, who said in 1970, the members of the death squad are policemen, and everyone knows it. As depicted in State of Siege, these groups engaged in kidnapping, torture, assassination, and bombing. Their victims ranged from petty criminals to students, folk singers, academics, and political activists. Week after week, the Latin American press announces the death of yet another body. Some estimates of the number of persons executed by death squads in Brazil exceeds 1,500. Frequently, the bodies of these victims are found with cards boasting of the work of the death squad. Clearly, the intent is to intimidate the population. The use of terrorism is to intimidate third world populations and is considered an essential element of America's post-Vietnam strategy for social control in the third world, since it is obvious that the American public will not permit massive numbers of U.S. ground troops to be employed in future counter-revolutionary wars. The Nixon administration seeks to eliminate all threats to pro-U.S. third world regimes without deploying U.S. combat forces. By building up a powerful and ruthless police force in each country, the United States can ensure that radical movements will be destroyed before they present a significant military threat. This preemptive strategy was described by Undersecretary of State U. Alexis Johnson in a 1971 speech to IPA graduates as follows. Effective policing is like preventative medicine. The police can deal with threats to internal order in their formative states. Should they not be prepared to do this, major surgery may be required in the sense that considerable force would be needed to redress those threats. This action is painful and expensive and often disruptive in itself. Unquote.
That is sickening. Oh.
So there we have it. Basically, plain talk, consistent with all the reading I've ever done on death squads, which basically says that the death squads are basically just the police and the military working frequently with other elements, often organized crime, and they're doing it like moonlighting, basically, like off-duty type of shit.
Right. Yeah. Doing, I mean, well, and it's funny that they describe it as preventative healthcare, preventative medicine, whatever, because like you think of, again, it kind of is like, you know, Batman or Punisher, whatever we're talking about. Like, you think of that as being this very precise, like, careful, considered, like, you know, you're excising just the maybe malignant freckle, right, before it turns into melanoma or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, they're killing fucking cousins, third cousins of suspected leftists or whatever. Like, there's nothing precise about it. It's a terror campaign that is so gruesome and bloody that, you know, you, no matter how devout your beliefs are that like a better world is possible, you're like, well, I don't want my, you know, my beautiful niece to get, you know, who's 2 years old to get slaughtered. So I can't go to this, you know, march with these striking workers or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's like, they're not fucking fans of preventative medicine. That's not a thing they end up funding in these countries in the first place. So it's a stupid metaphor on top of everything.
No. Oh, yeah. Oh, God. That really... The other thing that you said that was, like, very... when he's, like, they call themselves an eye for an eye, and isn't, like, mm-hmm. that's in the Bible, right? That makes the whole world... Like, that's, yeah, the...
Jesus said, don't do that.
Yeah, don't do that, right? Like, not only is that not what you're doing, but even if it were, God, I hate that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways...
So bad. So that is why Dan Mitrione had to be kidnapped. Let's talk about the kidnapping just a little bit. So one Latin American journalist wrote, speaking of Uruguay, right? He said, it was little different from conditions 40 and 50 years earlier in the United States, except that every Brazilian John L. Lewis and Eugene Debs had been killed, jailed, or hounded underground. So, like, these countries don't get the chance to even have that left that wasn't, like, in the U.S., those guys were, like, harassed and thrown in jail and shit. Right. In other countries, they were just fucking killed.
Yeah, right.
So, like, that's important to keep in mind in terms of, like, the U.S. does certainly get a lighter touch, even though it's still really fucking bad. Like, it's not,
right.
Yeah. So, yeah, so basically all the death squad and torture stuff, that's valuable context for why the Tupamaros started fighting back hard. And to my enjoyment, they were fighting back with almost bizarrely great precision, right? Because we talked about this, but the Tupamaros took out multiple members of this anti-terrorist unit. I'm doing air quotes, which only CJ can see. Because this was the death squad unit.
Right.
They knew who these people were, and they knew exactly who Mitrione was, and they kidnapped him. And it's actually really funny because this New York Times reporter I keep, you know, mentioning, he found a cable that Mitrione wrote a few weeks before he was kidnapped, where he was writing back to Washington, D.C., and he wrote, "It is felt that police will continue to be a target and that there may be other attempts to kidnap and or kill key police officers." And he wrote that just a few weeks before he was kidnapped.
Writing on the wall there, bucko.
So I think I mentioned earlier that, like, the conversation between the Tupamaro interrogator and Mitrione is out there. I don't think it's public, but there is a portion that made its way into the book, Hidden Terrors, by Langoth. And I would like to read the Tupamaro side, right? This is just a portion of a longer part of the interrogation, but the Tupamaro says, "We really don't like to kill people at all, but we will. And we do when it's necessary. We killed Moran Chaquero with a smile, you know, because we knew we were doing something that our comrades would thank us for. because he really was a torturer, and there are many, and we will kill every one of them sooner or later. And Mitrione said, well, the only thing I regret about all this, I don't like the thing that is that many people, innocent people, suffer. My wife and children at home, there's no reason for them to be suffering. To which the Tupamaro said, I have a wife and children too. But you know, you do it for money, and I don't.
That's beautiful.
And I thought that was a good exchange between the two of them.
It is very cool that those tapes exist, and we can kind of see that supported. And then see Costa Gavras depicting it with such, accuracy. And what would we say? When that movie came out? In the 70s?
I forget. Let me see.
Google.
72.
Yeah.
It's wild. So wild.
Wild.
I think I mentioned this maybe, but the Tupamaro interrogator of Mitrione, the real life one, mm-hmm. was probably a gorilla named Blanco Catras. And if, no, I mean, nobody knows, because Blanco Catras was killed in a police raid in April of 1972. But the reason why it's likely, one reason is because Blanco Catras spoke English, because he studied abroad in the United States.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. What's really wild is that both the police, obviously they went to the torture schools in the US, and a lot of the Tupamaro actually also studied abroad in the US. So bizarrely, there were connections on both sides to different US things. It's wild.
Huh.
Yeah. Let's see here. So, like we said, the Tupamaros thought they'd be able to trade Mitrione for 150 of their comrades. And like we said, this was actually not that crazy of a possibility, given the Orrego administration. And I think I failed to mention this, but dude, inflation in Uruguay was way, way out of control. It was almost like a Weimar Germany situation in terms of their currency was just going down and down. Or, I mean, I guess inflation was rising. I saw crazy numbers, 160%.
Holy shit. And that was because of the situation post-World War II.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all the economic stuff prior to the Civil War, basically.
Right, yeah. Yikes.
Yeah, so basically what the Tupamaros were trying to do was they were trying to get their comrades freed first and foremost. But the other thing they thought they could do, and this did kind of work to a certain point, was they thought that they could expose Mitrione and his activities and thereby cause an end to the OPS system in Uruguay and in other countries,
right,
by shedding a light on it. So it was never just let's free these comrades or we kill him. It was that, and it was a chess move to try to show the world what was going on.
Right. Which, and the movie plays that out with the one intrepid journalist who's why this guy? Of everybody in the country,
yeah.
That's the right question to be asking. Did that, obviously it didn't end things, but what was the, were journalists covering that?
Yeah, probably the best thing to come out of this whole affair was heavy scrutiny on all of this shit. State of siege played a role, but many countries, especially in Latin America, less so in the US given the control over the press,
right.
Really everyone was just what the fuck is this?
Right.
And so it's interesting because the Nixon administration was just a year old at the time that Mitrione was kidnapped. And President Nixon opposed any trade or deal of any kind. So none was made.
This is Nixon's Bay of Pigs.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, much lower scale, but
right.
He just drew that hard line and it meant Mitrione died. Granted, I'm sure he didn't probably lose any sleep over it, but
yeah, no.
So the Tupamaros made the decision to kill him because the trade of prisoners didn't happen.
It was the right decision.
So it didn't work out very well for the Tupamaros, though, because the Uruguayan General Assembly, the same day Mitrione was found to be dead, they declared a state of emergency and suspended the Constitution. That included the right of property, assembly, personal liberty, and free expression. I don't think if you like look at like, oh, the Wikipedia page, it talks about a civil war, but there was a civil war going on, and this intensified. And it wasn't just one-sided, at least for a time, because the Tupamaros blew up a bowling alley, not with people inside, that was patronized by the US expat community, which is to say, hey, we know where you guys fucking hang out,
Right.
and basically sending a warning. And they blew up a nightclub where the expats like to be, to like party. And on the wall, they wrote in like spray paint, Bailan todos o no baila nadie. Everyone dances or no one dances.
Oh yeah.
Which is like a beautiful sentiment, in my opinion.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And I think it's better than Emma Goldman's one, where it's like, if there's not dancing, it's not a revolution. It's like, grow the fuck up, okay? Like, everyone's dancing or nobody's dancing. How about that?
I was gonna ask something for my own sake. The dilemma that and Mitrione in the movie identi well, you know, the, yeah, Mitrione in the movie identifies this for them, but like they kind of had to kill him, right, from a strategic perspective. They couldn't, if they'd let him go, then I mean they're rolling over and asking for belly rubs.
Yeah, like you can't basically kidnap people and say we're going to kill you unless you get, you know, like
Yeah, you're right.
we can debate whether kidnappings should happen. I don't know if it's like a wise or good like political move, but at the same time, if you do it, you would have to follow through. Yeah.
Right.
And like, it's not to like mitigate kidnapping in any way, but like, kidnapping in Latin America was a fairly common thing, even for criminals to do. Granted, I mean, I don't think that like your insurgency should be doing things criminals do in terms of
Right.
like, it's not like a good move. But the thing is, the Tupamaros were not necessarily like envisioning like storming the country the way Castro did.
Right.
You know, it was like much more like we're trying to like push policy in this direction or this direction. Like, it's a very interesting question of tactics.
Right. Well, I mean, I think we talked about how, from our vantage point in 2023, like, Tupamaros, it looks like, I mean, they're like on a long enough timeline, their tactics worked out pretty well for them. So, I mean, you know, just saying.
Yeah.
If
Dream big.
you take nothing else from this program, dream big.
So soon enough, right, the Uruguayan military carried out a coup against the president who, well, okay, so the Pacheco Areco guy, he got voted out, like pretty much in the next election. And then the next guy who was in did not a very good job, according to the Uruguayan military. And so they carried out a bloodless coup and basically just dissolved the General Assembly. No more Uruguayan Congress or Parliament. And they would not have any democracy for the next 11 years.
Wild.
Yeah. And at one point, Uruguay had the largest number of political prisoners per capita in the world. Granted, right? Because they're a small country.
Right.
And one Uruguayan Catholic priest said torture was routine and automatic.
Wow.
The problem, too, was that Uruguayan radicals could not do the classic Latin American thing of just going to the next country over, because the next country over was Brazil and Argentina,
Right.
where there were death squads waiting for them. So the dissident Uruguayan author Eduardo Galeano, who wrote Las Venas Abiertas de America Latina, the open veins of Latin America, he spoke of this period of Uruguayan history and said, people were in prison so that prices could be free.
Love it. I mean, that's the whole, I mean, that's neoliberalism, right? Like, that's the Chicago boys had to implement it somewhere.
That's right.
And then you, like we just said, you bring it back. You bring it back 20 years later.
That's right.
No, it reminds me, sorry to, just because I've got 2666 on the brain. I don't know if you guys talked about it in the episode, and if you did, tell me, shut up. But when one of the characters compares the killings to striking workers, which is like a very chilling, I mean, it's I still am like kind of chewing on what that means, like the different ways you can take that. But yeah, the relation, I mean, it's wild to see so many people not in America just openly and clearly being like, yeah, there is a direct relationship between violence and capitalism. Like, they are the same. They are hand in hand. You can't have one without the other.
Yeah, because like all of the, like, it's literally all economics. Like, the excess profits that would normally go to Uruguayans to share in some form of social democracy were getting sucked up by U.S. imperialism. So there was no room for any form of like Uruguayan social democracy or like a welfare state.
Right. They couldn't afford it to maintain. Yeah. They were going to maintain, if the U.S. was going to maintain its, you know, economic hegemony down there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's just a, like a one-to-one direct relationship. So Costa Gavras, the director, right? He hired an Italian screenwriter, right? Franco Salinas, to write this movie. And I think we mentioned this before. He was an Italian in the Communist Party, and he wrote The Battle of Algiers. So Costa Gavras went to Montevideo in 1972 to gather information. Salinas went to the Dominican Republic. You know, he confirmed Mitrione was there. And he, as far as I know, that he's still the main source for that claim, although I'm pretty sure it's probably true.
Right.
So State of Siege came out in 1972, very much when the Uruguayan dictatorship was like still running the country. You know, we talked about the fallout of Mitrione's kidnapping and including the movie and the shining the light on all this stuff. U.S. Congress abolished the public safety program in direct response to the overall campaign of pushback against all of this shit, which included the movie. That was like a major element of it.
Oh, yeah.
So like Costa Gavras clearly made the world better in a direct way other than just through art. Very cool.
That is awesome.
Mm-hmm. Now, because Congress basically got rid of the public safety program, the powers that be that wanted it in the first place, they used several sleights of hand to deal with it. In the short term, they relied more and more on Israeli and British trainers to train these death squads in especially places like Colombia. It's not that things necessarily got better in Latin America, but the long-term solution was to switch into a war on drugs, which would provide cover for counterinsurgency operations.
That's if you want more on that, read Drug Cartels Do Not Exist.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is the bleakest episode that we've done. Every time.
I'm sorry. Yeah. It won't always get bleaker and bleaker. I swear we can do one that's better.
It's okay. I don't mind. I'll be the sin eater. But no, it's just wild, man. It's wild how fucked up we just destroyed an entire continent. Multiple, really. But
yeah, well,
magnitudes of evil, you can't even, I, you know,
it's from just this point on, I think we've got some wholesome stories coming. So,
hell yeah. Yeah.
cabeza de un noble potrillo que justo en la raya afloja al llegar y que al regresar parece decir no olvides hermano, vos sabés, no hay que jugar por una cabeza me tejón de un día de aquella coqueta y risueña mujer que al jurar sonriendo el amor que está mintiendo quema en una hoguera todo mi querer. Por una cabeza todas las locuras, tu boca que besa borra la tristeza, calma la amargura. Por una cabeza perderme mil veces la vida, ¿para qué vivir? Cuánto desengaño por una cabeza, yo juré mil veces, no vuelvo a insistir. Pero si un mirar me hiere al pasar, tu boca de fuego otra vez quiero besar. Basta de carreras, se acabó la timba, un final reñido yo no vuelvo a ver. Pero si algún bingo llega a ser fija el domingo, yo me juego entero, ¿qué le voy a hacer? Por una cabeza, toda la locura, tu boca que besa, borra la tristeza, calma la amargura, por una cabeza. Perderme mil veces la vida, ¿para qué vivir?
So you're on record as a Florida boy.
Born and raised.
That's right. You're a Florida boy. You're a Tampa boy.
Yep, correct.
Have you ever heard of the guy named Philip Agee who wrote Inside the Company CIA Diary?
Yeah, I've definitely heard the name for sure.
Did you know he was a Tampa boy too?
I did not.
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't even realize because I read the book. I didn't really pay attention to, like, you know, where he grew up. But yeah, he was from Tampa. So he comes up here, right? Because in 1975, part of the general, like, shift into, like, world culture being like, what the fuck is the CIA doing?
Right.
He publishes the book Inside the Company, CIA Diary. And he was stationed in Uruguay. Granted, he was there from 1964 to 1966. So before things got really, really bad. But he writes about how he did all kinds of heinous shit. Not as bad as torture and death squads, but he did black journalism, disinformation, bribery, wiretapping, black bag jobs. They would plant stories. They'd fund anti-communist groups. They undermined coalitions on the left, all kinds of terrible shit. He, in a different book that he wrote, he said, "I used to think that if left-wing Ecuadorians, Uruguayans, or Mexicans ever found out what I was really up to, they would make it impossible for me to remain in their country."
Yeah. Sounds like he was probably right.
And, you know, I believe in love. I know you believe in love.
Hell yeah, brother.
Philip Agee believes in love, and he would go on to date a woman named Angela Camargo Seixas. I don't know how you pronounce that in Portuguese, but she was a former Brazilian former radical student who had been tortured by the very same people that Mitrione trained.
Wow.
And Philip Agee very much knew the story of Dan Mitrione, and he published Inside the Company anyway, which I don't know if you've read it, but he burned 250 CIA officers knowing that the worst thing that could happen to them would be Dan Mitrione dying.
Wow. I was going to ask, I've seen the name, but I don't really know shit. Was he, so, because, you know, you hear defector CIA agent office or whatever, you think limited hangout, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do we think, is that like the consensus on Philip Agee, or was he really have a change of heart?
I think he probably was a legitimate defector because he ended up having to live in Cuba.
Yeah, see, I pulled his
Yeah.
Google and he died in Cuba, and I was like, that's cool. Good for him.
Beautiful. So that's
Okay.
pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you'd hope that dating or marrying, I forget if he's dating or married, but like a former radical student, so, I mean, that does sound legitimate.
I think he was Catholic, maybe, but he definitely like took a left turn, like a pretty sharp one,
Hell yeah.
after deciding he didn't want to go to hell, I guess. So can't blame him, I guess. But
Love it.
let's see. Okay, so we're left with two major unresolved questions regarding the Tupamaros, right? The first one is, how were they so effective when they were operational? And how were they so quickly neutralized after a certain point?
Right.
And the answer in both cases appears to be spying, espionage, infiltration.
Intelligence.
Yeah, intelligence. So we'll go through the first, well, like, basically, this is a story of like infiltration for good and bad. And so the first case, the good case, right? Okay. Basically, there was a man named Manuel Hevia Cosculela, who was a Cuban American who grew up in Connecticut, where he like went to school in Connecticut. He spoke perfect English. He was like, I think his dad was a diplomat maybe in like Bautista's Cuba or something. And he went to law school in Havana, once he grew up. And in 1962, he basically sought asylum in the Uruguayan embassy and then went into exile in Miami. In Miami, he was recruited by the CIA, and unbeknownst to the CIA at the time, he was already working for Cuban intelligence.
Nice.
And they encouraged him to do, like, yeah, fucking join the CIA.
Right, yeah.
And so he did. And he had a connection to the Uruguayans already. And so basically, he worked for the CIA from 1962 to 1970. And at a certain point, I'm gonna like eventually tell the story more fully, but I'm still reading the book because I read slowly in Spanish. But he was working with the Public Safety Division of AID in Montevideo, Uruguay.
Wow.
He reported directly to William Cantrell, who was a CIA officer in deep cover for USAID. Cantrell worked directly with Mitrione.
Yeah.
Hevia worked with Mitrione. All three of them, they knew each other.
Wow.
And yeah, I know. And so Hevia said that Cantrell told him that Mitrione was not part of our program, meaning the CIA, but that Mitrione did work very closely with the CIA in Brazil. Which is probably the main reason why I don't think Mitrione was literally formally CIA. Although at the end of the day, the distinction doesn't matter too much,
Right.
I think, right? So in 1970, Cuban intelligence told him to come in from the cold, to come back to Cuba,
Nice.
the warm, loving embrace of Cuba.
Havana, love it.
That's right. So he did, and he came back, and he debriefed and told all the information he had to first Cuban intelligence, but after that, he wrote a book. The book is called Passport 11333, 8 Years with the CIA. And basically, he lays out in all of its like ugly details all the stuff he knew from working closely with Mitrione. And he is the source of the claim that Mitrione tortured to death 4 homeless Uruguayan men. So this is just one of many examples of Cuban intelligence punching so far above their weight class.
Absolutely kicking ass. Oh my God. Just goaded.
They're so good.
Absolutely goaded.
They're so good.
Wow. You know, it's like watching Jordan. You know, It's like watching Lance Armstrong. It's what a crew. I wish I knew more about sailing because it's a team effort. You know what I mean? Like it's
Yeah.
every agent has their oar and they're just like fucking hauling ass down the road.
They're like the Harlem Globetrotters of just like putting up big numbers on the board.
Absolutely. That rules. I did Google, I Googled the William Cantrell and see like just the phrase William Cantrell CIA, and what comes up is a 1978 article from the New York Times. Cuban agent says US police aides urge torture, and like the fourth paragraph down, he says, if you ask me whether any American official participated in torture, I'd say yes. Dan Mitrione participated, Mr. Hevia said at a news conference. If you ask me whether there were interrogations, I'd say no, because the unfortunate beggars who were being tortured have had no way of answering because they were asked no questions. They were merely guinea pigs to show the effect of electric shock on different parts of the human body. But yeah, that's wild though. He maintained cover for what, he said 8 years, 62 to 70, right?
That's right.
Oh
I
man.
mean, it was a couple more years too, because it took him a year or two to get into the CIA.
Oh man. Yeah, that is really, really good shit.
Yeah, very heartwarming story. I mean, like, so he wrote that book, and I think it was like published in Spain, and it was like a major, a bestseller, I think, in like other parts of Latin America. But I don't think it was ever published in the US. There's not an English version, and there's no ISBN number. So this is like when all those fucking losers are like, read banned books. It's like, okay, motherfucker, why don't you read a book that is actually frowned upon in this country?
Right. Instead of like fucking Animal Farm or whatever.
Yeah.
Oh, that, yeah. And I mean, I'm Google again, not that Google has become absolute dog shit now, but I just Googled his name. First hit is the article that I just quoted from
The New York Times one, yeah.
New York Times. And then it looks like a WordPress blog, but yeah, it's not, I mean, there's like
Almost nothing.
almost nothing. It looks like a German publication of his books or his book.
Yeah, I had to get it my copy from Spain.
Yeah, is that the book that you said you ordered, a Cuban book through by way of Spain? That rocks.
Yeah. The for listeners, the cover is a almost like a sardine tin can,
It looks like just
and
like.
there's a fucking swastika coming out of the tin can.
Right.
Amazing.
Well, the wait, but you got to tell me.
Yeah.
Cover of the tin can is the C it says CIA, and then in can is, yeah, swastika. Beautiful.
Amazing. So the CIA, of course, always refuses to comment on defections. So they didn't comment on Hevia's defection, but the New York Times reporter Langoth, right? He actually met Hevia in 1979, and they exchanged notes over Mitrione because they both wrote books about fundamentally the same evil fucker. And Langoth stated that he believes Hevia's claims. So the worst claims were that Mitrione murdered four homeless men in order to demonstrate his, the torture techniques and so forth. Because otherwise, Mitrione claims, often mostly accurately, that he wasn't actually around when people were getting interrogated, when the police were doing it. And like, that is mostly true. He didn't actually seem to be around because, like, they speak Spanish, they can do it. Like, you teach a man to fish and so forth.
Unfortunate uses of a good
I
parable.
know. Here's the thing though, okay? So the Tupamaros were just like punching way high, knocking out the death squad members
Blowing up bullying dance.
and going after Mitrione and so forth. Here's the question: were they working with Cuban intelligence? And as it turns out, the answer is probably.
Hell yeah.
We don't know for sure, but we do know that hundreds of Tupamaros took military training in Cuba. And the head of the Tupamaros, more or less, Raul Sendic, at least the most prominent member, most famous maybe. He went to Cuba and received training as early as 1960.
Nice.
So it's not to say that the Tupamaros were, you know, working for Cuban intelligence, but they worked with each other, right?
Right. Which is, I mean, that's what you'd want to see, especially when you have, you know, this kind of, it's not this, I mean, the U.S. wasn't doing the same thing in every country, but there, it's very similar, right? Like, you have this orchestrated assault across the entire continent. Like, yeah, you'd want these groups to be sharing intelligence, sharing technologies and skills and things like that.
Yeah, exactly.
That's awesome.
So I know what you're thinking. This episode isn't long enough and there aren't enough tangents. And where's the Mormon connection? Right? I'm sure everybody's asking, what's the Mormon angle to the Tupamaros story?
You get CJ and Jimmy on a podcast, you've got to talk Mormons.
That's right. Now I'm going to tell the story of the Mormon Tupamaro.
I can't wait. This rules.
Okay, so this is the story of a guy named Francisco Guillermo Billy Real Castillo, henceforth known as Billy Real. He was a Uruguayan. He had a whole family. And the Real family encountered Mormon missionaries when they started proselytizing. I don't know exactly when, but probably in the 50s or 60s. And the Real family joins the Mormon church. And Billy was the classic case of like an all-star convert. He went on not one, not two, but three different missions.
Oh, wow.
This was back before it was like always like 2 years, you know? So like some of these were probably shorter, but still.
But still, yeah, I mean.
Yeah, it's still a big deal. And he went on missions to Chile, Brazil, and Italy. And he spoke Spanish, English, Portuguese, and Italian. I saw a blog, I don't know if it's true, but I saw a blog, like a Mormon blog, not like a left politics blog, right, claim that Billy Real was the first member of the Mormon church from South America to serve a Mormon mission outside of South America.
Oh, yeah.
Which, I mean, for Mormons, that's like, wow, that's cool.
Yeah, right.
When the promotional goodwill tour of the Deseret basketball team came to Uruguay, all that great soft power, soft cultural power, Billy Real was the tour's director of public relations, and he was the spokesman for them on radio and in interviews.
Nice.
I think, did I send you the poster for the Deseret basketball team, CJ?
No, but I have thoughts about the Deseret, just like,
yeah.
Yeah, what, I mean.
I'm going to put it in the chat here so you can see it.
Yeah, let me see. Utahns are good at a lot, but I don't know them to be great at basketball.
I mean, pre-black people really entering, they were probably hooping pretty well.
That's true. Here, let me see. Meeting chat.
Los Mormones.
Oh, that's great. Oh, yeah. Those are the Mormon boys. Look at that.
That's right. It almost looks like space suits, but it's like yeah. Jumpsuits or whatever.
Yeah, like reflective jumpsuits. That's amazing.
So, yeah, he was just like a big deal, basically.
Nice.
So one of, I think at least one of the Mormon missionaries who converted Billy's family was from Centerville, Indiana. Okay.
Okay.
So this missionary ended up marrying one of Billy's sisters, which is kind of a common thing in Mormonism. It's a little weird, but well, it's very common.
Right.
And due to that, and just the fact that a lot of Uruguayans were studying in the US, Billy went to study abroad in the US. And Billy Real ended up working for a machine tools company, which I somewhat schizophrenically note has loose affiliations with the US intelligence community. Not saying anything about Billy per se, I'm just making a note of it. Now, here's where thing. This is where I get genuinely dizzy, okay? Because Centerville, Indiana basically borders Richmond, Indiana, okay? And as it turns out, Billy Real had met Ray Mitrione, who is Dan Mitrione's brother, in Indiana.
Huh.
As it turns out, Dan Mitrione's brother ran a sporting goods store in Richmond. And Billy went there and met him in June of 1970, 2 months before Dan would be kidnapped in July of 1970. So, interesting. Okay. So, we know all of this very precisely because there's actually articles about this Uruguayan kid coming to study abroad in this newspaper, the Palladium Item and Sun Telegram newspaper for Richmond, Indiana. From June 1970. And here's the headline: Mid-Americans warm, human, sincere, says Uruguayan, which is an example of like the bullshit small town newspaper just reporting the most worthless stories ever.
Yeah, right.
It literally is just a Uruguayan student saying, yeah, like Americans are pretty cool,
It's pretty
pretty
cool
neat.
here. Oh, look at that. That headline is extremely fascist. Like, I can't, I
Yeah.
would take a minute to explain it, but like, it is so like that, like, gross small town. Yeah.
It's so stupid.
So stupid.
So I realize so far that I've given the listener no good reason to care about Billy Real other than saying, teasing that he was a Tupamaro. Okay. As it turns out, Billy Real was involved in some way with the massive jailbreak of Tupamaros that happened on September 6, 1971. Now, for the listeners out there, over 100 Tupamaros were able to escape prison, maximum security prison, including top leadership, including Raul Sendic. Like, basically everybody that got rounded up, like during this huge crackdown for like the Uruguayan dictatorship, they all got out of prison. And here's how it was reported in the press. Okay. There were all kinds of stories, including this one that I got from Time magazine. The prison break was executed with all the attention to detail and derring do of a commando raid. Early one evening last week, two well-dressed young men called at the home of Billy Real Castillo, 30, a Mormon missionary who lives across the street from Montevideo's Punta Carreta Federal Prison. "We are Tupamaros," said the men as they pulled out pistols and identified themselves as members of the urban guerrilla group that has served as a model for terrorists in many of the world's major cities. "We need this house for an operation." The operation was a massive jailbreak by 106 Tupamaros, self-styled Robin Hood revolutionaries who take their name from Tupac Amaru, an 18th-century Inca chief who led a revolt against Spain. Two intruders applied a medical stethoscope to the living room floor where they detected the sounds below. They broke a hole into it. Next door, meanwhile, a Volkswagen van drew up and unloaded half a dozen more Tupamaros, who quickly commandeered the house and lugged in a dozen or so suitcases filled with clothing, arms, false papers, and money. All was quiet. Equally thorough preparations were being made inside the prison by Tupamaros, who were confined in cells on the third floor. These cells had already been clandestinely connected by chipping away the mortar so that bricks could be removed and replaced with ease. Holes had been drilled in the end cells on each floor, allowing the Tupamaros to move from their third floor cells to the second and first floors on makeshift ladders of blankets and wood. By the time the break took place, a tunnel had already been dug, leading from a ground floor cell and under the prison wall to the Real House. Prison officials, who later discovered picks, shovels, and heavy-duty drills, said that some of the dirt had been stored in pillowcases and mattresses, but most of the estimated 10 tons of earth brought out from the 130-foot tunnel had been shoveled into an intersecting tunnel that was used for a 1931 prison break and never filled in. The guerrillas had even managed to rig a plastic and cardboard bellows to provide air for the diggers. CJ, I put a picture of the of like it's, a yeah. It's so
beautiful.
Okay, a little bit more from this Time magazine article. The first of the 111 escapees, the 106 guerrillas plus five other prisoners with no clear links to the Tupamaros, surfaced through the Real living room floor at 3 a.m. the next day. They quickly changed into new clothes. Small signs directed them to the house next door, where they picked up arms and identification papers. An hour later, trucks whisked them away into the morning darkness. When Billy Real phoned the police to report the break, they said all is quiet at the prison, as in like the guard said that.
Yeah.
When Billy called back, the prison guards grudgingly checked the cells and insisted everything was fine. Not until half an hour after Billy's first call did the guards finally discover that a truly monumental escape had taken place. The next day, the prison director resigned. 3 days after the break, the Tupamaros distributed a bulletin in Montevideo, and it read, "A year ago, we started a battle for political prisoners." Since then, and close quote, since then, there had been the mid-July escape of 30 Tupamaro women and now the bigger jailbreak by the men. So my words here, by pure chance, Billy Real was living in the house that the Tupamaros happened to need for their jailbreak. Now, I would be lying to you if I didn't express some skepticism about how this story played out. Although it was widely reported in both U.S. and Spanish language newspapers that he played no role other than the one he told the police, which is that they commandeered his house. And that they told him, like, okay, a half hour after we leave, call the prison.
Call the prison, right. You know, if you're just like a nice, upstanding Mormon boy, you probably wouldn't want to be, you know, lumped in with Tupamaros. It's easier to just be like, yeah, they just kind of showed up. And I don't know.
Damn, that's crazy.
Right. Yeah, I mean, like, of all the people, you know, like the person who's, you know, it sounds like, and, you know, say what you will about, you know, organized religion or whatever and mission work and stuff. But, you know, this person was a devout, genuine believer,
mm-hmm.
And wanted, you know, would almost certainly look at people in a Uruguayan prison in the 70s as being held in unjust and ungodly conditions, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's, I think, well, you know, and even if we're wrong, why not? Why not believe in the Mormon Tupamaro? Yeah, what harm comes from it? But it's also very likely.
Here's the thing, CJ. The story continues.
Ah, okay.
Okay, let's see here. So the book, The Tupamaros by Maria Esther Gilio, she seems to believe that Billy Real was not working for the Tupamaros. However, Ray Mitrione, Dan's brother, the guy with the sporting goods store, he did not buy the story. And I quote from the book Hidden Terrors by the journalist Langoth, right? Which says, "In Richmond, Ray Mitrione read of the jailbreak and noticed that one of the occupants of the house through which the Tupamaros escaped was named Billy Real. Since Ray first received a tape of the interrogation between his brother and the English-speaking Tupamaro, he had been playing it over and over, listening for clues. This obsession went on so long that his family urged him for his own sake to give it up. To Ray, the voice on the tape sounded like that of the young Uruguayan he had met. Now he saw Billy Rail's name in print, connected with the Tupamaros in that suspicious way, and he called Washington, D.C. to tell them the whole story. In Montevideo, Billy Real, a convert to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, was arrested and jailed. The Montevideo police granted that although Mormons were almost never revolutionaries, wink, possibly Rial was an exception. But Ray had been mistaken about the voice he heard interrogating his brother. Most likely the voice belonged to a Tupamaro named Blanco Catras, who had studied in the United States and was killed in a Uruguayan police raid in 1972. So at least one guy thinks that possibly Billy Rial could have been the guy interrogating Dan Mitrione in the first place.
Right.
And I could never really find any evidence that he was that interrogator, and I couldn't find any evidence that he was a Tupamaro prior to this point.
Right.
What Lenguth fails to mention is that Ray Mitrione's suspicions, and maybe there's evidence, I don't know, because this is a dictatorship which is not known for like assiduously proving someone's guilt before inflicting punishment.
Right.
Lenguth says that Mitrione's suspicions got Billy Rial sent to prison. Right. So I saw different sources say that Billy Rial was sent to prison for 6 years. And I saw other sources, these are Spanish language, suggesting that if Billy wasn't a Tupamaro before going to prison, he was a Tupamaro after going to prison.
Right.
So we actually have some insight into this too from some of the top leadership of the Tupamaros. A guy named Eleuterio Fernandez Huidobro, also known as El Ñato, who was like maybe the second or third top guy in the Tupamaros. And he, at a certain point, you know, fairly recently, was one of the last living survivors of that jailbreak.
Wow.
Yeah, he was interviewed late in life when almost everybody was dead. And I'll read from my translation of this interview. And he had already talked about the jailbreak in most of the interview. And so, like, this is towards the end of the interview where, okay, so the question is, what happened when the police came? And El Ñato said, the one who got into trouble later was Billy, a very good boy who was very important among the Mormons and who ended up in jail. He was jailed for 6 years. Question, but did Billy belong to the MLN, which is to say the Tupamaros? Ñato says, we really don't know. We always loved him very much. He was a great person, very religious. He died a while ago. So to make that more clear, Huidobro doesn't know, or he won't say, that Billy Rial right. was a Tupamaro before the jailbreak. Right?
Right.
But it still doesn't end, because he, Huidobro, wrote a book called basically like the jailbreak of Punta Carretas, right? And he wrote a passage or a chapter about Billy, and it was entitled They Forgot About Billy. And I had translated that too, okay? And this says, in homage and memory to Comrade Francisco Guillermo Rial Castillo El Billy, who died on March 13th, 2011, imprisoned under the dictatorship of the Libertad prison under, you know, whichever law they were imprisoned right. under. And it says, on September 6, 1971, when the last man escaped from the Punta Carretas prison, the number totaled 111, at least according to the media and the government communiques. That's what the Tupamaros communiques reported too. The leaders of the prison decided who would go into the tunnel first and who would be the last. We knew the number because we prepared the infrastructure and logistics, the clothing, accommodations, documents, and food for 111 men. When the last Tupamaro, number 111, crawled through the tunnel, hoisted to freedom, the number added up to exactly 111, just as we had planned. They were divided into two trucks, which drove off in two different directions. In the middle of the living room was the mouth of this tunnel, a true feat of engineering. 111 men came through that tunnel, but there was one more Tupamaro yet to come. When the last of the comrades walked out of the door of that house, there remained one Tupamaro, Tupamaro 112, Billy Rial, who waited the appropriate necessary time before reporting that the Tupamaros had escaped. Let's see here. And then, yeah, he basically, there's a passage talking about him, like, calling the police, you know.
Right.
It continues saying, that night, Billy Rial fled from an unfair, arbitrary, anti-democratic, repressive, dictatorial society. Billy fled with the rest of the organization. He escaped from a comfortable middle-class life in Punta Carretas to assume the militant commitment of the MLNT, the Tupamaros, for a more just and egalitarian society, for national liberation, for socialism, and all the consequences that such a decision implied. Wearing gray overalls and shaved bald, Billy shared many years in the Libertad prison along with the same colleagues who escaped through his house. He was a member of Column 10. Nobody knows who recruited him or when, if before, during, or after the escape. What does it matter anyway? Tupamaro 112 has now escaped yet again, through death. Wherever he is, I'm sure he will proudly shout, "Hey, the Tupamaros escaped. They went to my house, and I'm with them, damn it." Unquote.
That's a great story. I think there's nothing. One of my very favorite things is a person whose religious beliefs steer them towards the politics that, you know, their beliefs ought to entail.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm sure is, I mean, you see that a lot with like Latin American Catholics. And it's very, very rare in America, but that is
rare for Mormons too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But in all earnestness, that is one of my, it just warms my heart to hear stories like that.
What I'm so happy about personally is that the leftists don't seem to really, like the Tupamaros in Uruguay and like the associated groups don't really give a shit necessarily about him being Mormon, and the Mormons really don't want to claim him. So like, I'm the only fucking person in the world who probably thinks this guy kicks ass. Like,
Well, okay. You appreciate him as a whole.
Yes.
You're not totality. You know, right, exactly.
Yeah, because the Tupamaros for sure think he's great.
Right, they just don't mention the LDS part. And then the church, it sounds like there's an official blog talking about him being the first South American Mormon to go on a mission not in South America. That's praise, and that's a big deal too, but they're not claiming him as a, warrior for socialism. So, but only on Program to Chill do you get the full portrait of
socialist
Mormon hero.
Good and bad.
That's right.
Like, and then when Comrade Billy died, I saw different like blogs and so forth, like Tupamaro blogs, call him a comrade, a protagonist of the struggle of the Uruguayan people and so forth. A Mormon Tupamaro. Can you freaking believe it?
That's beautiful. That's what we listen to this podcast for. That's what I come on for.
Hells yeah. Like, I was so happy to find that.
That rocks. We'll be right back.
Now, of course, we probably got to talk about the evil infiltration, right?
Bad guys, right.
Why did the Tupamaros fold so fast? And as it turns out, there's a major reason that they were infiltrated. And so there's this book I read, CJ. I've been meaning to tell you, it's really good. It's called The Great Heroin Coup, Drugs, Intelligence, and International Fascism by Heinrich Krüger. It is so freaking good. Basically, Krüger traces the history of this guy named Christian David. And he had a nickname, Beau Serge, which is like French for like beautiful Serge, almost like pretty boy or something like that.
Okay.
And he was an international narcotics trafficker. He also worked for, like, as an asset of different intelligence services of at least three nations. I want to say France, the U.S., and I forget the third because I read the book like a while ago. So, first and foremost, Christian David was a Corsican mobster, because you know the Corsicans used to be like the Colombians for like the drug trade,
right?
That like level of status or whatever.
That's the French connection is about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. And let's see. Christian David did all kinds of cool, crazy stuff, most of it bad. Like he faked madness at one point to like escape prison in France. And then he escaped the psychiatric institution because it was, you know, easier to escape from than prison.
Right. Yeah. Lower security.
And he told, like, he lived a crazy, ridiculous life. And he appears to have told a bunch of lies. So it's not always clear when he's telling the truth for some of these things. But half the book is like Krüger documenting which are true and which are fake for his stories.
Right.
But he seems to have been recruited for the SAC, the Service d'Action Civique, right? The parallel police that were used, like basically a death squad, let's be real, to take out the OAS back when there was like the deep state war in France between like pro and anti de Gaulle factions, kind of relating to the whole Algeria thing, right? Battle of Algiers type of shit.
Which I, not to do it too much of a tangent, but I recently just started scratching the surface of the whole Algerian thing. I was introduced to it for like forever ago because I think was Camus Algerian?
Yeah, like French Algerian, yeah.
He was French Algerian. Yeah, right. So I like, you know, and like I'd heard about it, but like that is some wild shit.
It's wild.
It's like, and the right wing in France, boy howdy, were those people sickos? Are those people, holy fuck, like that was like, oh.
They're nuts. They're just as crazy as US.
Yeah, like they are, oh my God. Yeah. Anyways, go on. I just want to.
Yeah, so this guy is basically like a handsome Johnny Roselli type of figure where he's like a mobster, a drug trafficker, working for spies in the French CIA thing, like
Right.
all that shit.
I'm gonna have to read this book.
Yeah, it kicks ass. So, okay, so basically during and after this deep state war, I mean, it was like a long affair. Christian David also worked with SDECE, which is, you know, one of the French intelligence agencies. He also worked with the CIA. He trafficked drugs with the Guarini brothers, who were maybe like the, they were never as famous, but they were almost kind of like the Pablo Escobar of like Corsican drug traffickers.
Right.
And then David was involved in a major deep political event. He was very credibly linked to the disappearance and, in all likelihood, the assassination of a Moroccan politician named Mehdi Ben Barka, who was a prominent left-wing Moroccan politician who disappeared in France in 1965. They're pretty sure that he just got murdered.
Right.
And if I'm not mistaken, I think that story got Kruger involved in this whole affair in the first place. And then he tracked the story of Christian David before and after. And that got him on the whole like heroin trade, which resulted in the rest of the book. The reason why I'm talking about it right now is that after a lot of his exploits in France in 1967, Christian David went to South America where he joined slash infiltrated the FAL, which is to say the Frente Argentino de Liberación, the Argentine Liberation Front. Okay.
Yeah.
It was a similar group to the Tupamaros, but in, you know, Argentina.
Argentina, right.
Now, he, Christian David, ingratiated himself into the organization through his access to guns and smuggling routes. I believe David at this point had a diplomatic passport, which the reason why he had that is a whole freaking story in and of itself, which I'm not going into. But he had the ability to smuggle drugs and guns with almost total impunity because of that.
Love it.
So he quickly rose up the ranks and became the FAL's arms instructor and supplier. But ultimately, he ended up shooting one of the FAL's leaders and stealing $250,000.
Holy shit.
Because I think the FAL did a lot of kidnapping, but like for money, basically, to fund an insurgency, which,
Right.
again, questionable tactics or whatever. But so Mitrione was already orchestrating a campaign against the Tupamaros and getting a lot of chess pieces in place to take them out. The death squads and the torture were only parts of it. He also brought Christian David in to basically do the same thing to the Tupamaros that he already did to the FAL. Christian David also started dating a Tupamaro, a woman named Teresa, and he started procuring them arms, and soon enough he became their arms dealer and their weapons instructor. So Kruger wrote, David must have been quite an actor since he even fooled the legendary Tupamaros leader Raul Sendic. After robbing a bank, the guerrillas handed Beau Serge $400,000 for the purchase of weapons. He then flew off, as if to complete the deal, to the beehive of the weapons trade, the African nation of Gabon. While he was away, the guerrillas somehow learned not of his escapades in Argentina, but of his role in the Ben Barka affair. They decided to set a trap for him, but once back in Uruguay, Christian David smelled trouble and rushed to the security police, who soon arrested the 150 guerrillas in the strongest blow they dealt the revolutionaries. It was a handsome feather in the cap of President Pacheco Areco. You know, stuff we
Yeah.
talked about. For his troubles, David was reportedly given $200,000 in addition to the $400,000 which he had relieved from the
Hold that.
Tupamaros, plus a Uruguayan diplomatic passport. in addition to the one he already had. With it, he traveled freely to the U.S. and Europe, controlling and expanding his international narcotics network. So, yes, I've told this out of order, right? Because we already told the story of those men escaping, but they pretty much got kidnapped partially due to Christian David's perfidy, right? And Christian David would just go on to live a full life of crime. He was one of the main guys in the French Connection. He was eventually arrested, and, you know, that's part of that's told in the Great Heroin Coup as well. He ended up serving 13 years in a U.S. prison. But, like, you see, who are the good guys in this story and who are the bad guys? It's like freaking night and day.
Yeah, it's like what are those old, like, pre-Shakespearean English, like, the super moral
Jacobean or whatever.
And not even before that, like, cycle plays, I think is what they're called. But they're like, they're basically like fables for children, morals.
Morality tales.
Yeah, exactly right. Like,
it's like the evil character has like a evil mustache and he's like,
right, twirling it and, you know, giving a speech about how, you know, he loves to like shoot dogs or whatever, shoot puppies.
Exactly. Yeah. So later in prison, Christian David would claim that the American mafia asked the Guarini brothers to kill JFK. And that the Guarini brothers sent a guy named Lucien Sarti, who was a real guy, a French mob hitman, as well as two other guys, to go kill JFK, which they did. But Christian David says that the CIA was not involved.
Oh, right, for sure. Yeah.
Absolutely, dude. Totally.
Yeah, man, whatever you say.
That's how you know this is a true story.
Right. Oh, man. That's why this Christian David, I'm going to have to read that book. That sounds...
It's so good, dude. So, supposedly, these three French hitmen did the hit, and then they flew to Montreal and got their payment in heroin. And, like, for what it's worth, I should mention Heinrich Krüger, who wrote the book, The Great Heroin Coup. He thinks that the, and I quote, U.S. cloak and dagger boys, unquote, fed Christian David the story as disinformation. And the obvious tip off is that he claims the CIA was not involved.
Right.
I'm actually pretty partial lately to the idea of a French hitman being involved. I really like a guy named H.P. Albarelli's book, where he basically points out this real French hitman named Jean-René Soutre. But I'm kind of agnostic as to who the actual shooters were. Agnostic in the sense that I'm not sure that it's known or that it can be proved.
Right. Is the French, not the French Connection, but is this French Connection tied in with, who was the Nazi that some people like to say was involved, who ended up working with Israeli intelligence? I should know his name.
Skorzeny?
Skorzeny, yeah.
Interestingly, it kind of does plug into Albarelli's theory. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Because
he was involved to a certain extent. It's just not clear how much.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's where I thought I'd heard that before.
Reading last I think James Ellroy I think he depicts French hitmen doing it in his novel, if I'm not mistaken.
I think I'm going to do his trilogy next after I finish 2666. Oh,
dude, you're going to have such a fun time.
Yeah. It's which is the one that you recommend? Is it the USA trilogy? Is that what it's called? Mm-hmm.
That's the one where the first one is JFK, the next one is RFK, the third one is like MLK.
Yeah. Yep. That's I think my next fiction that I'm going to tackle.
Freaking rocks.
Yeah. I got News of a Killing by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. I don't know if you've read that.
Which
news
one?
Of news of a Kidnapping.
I haven't read it, but
it's about like some Colombian. Marquez is a cool dude.
He was like actually like a good guy in real life.
Oh yeah, no, for sure. We should do it. If I'll read the book, if it's material, that's an episode.
That would be a good one.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Okay, anyways, let's get back to it.
So on his deathbed, Howard Hunt did tell his son there was a French gunman at the grassy knoll. And William Harvey, the FBI CIA guy, did hire French killers for ZR rifle hit teams. So maybe this is true. But the way Christian David tells it, almost certainly not true.
Not true at all, right?
But either way, how freaking nuts is it that the guy who infiltrated the Tupamaros and took them down to a certain extent might have been involved in the JFK hit, or at least knew about it? I don't think he said that he actually did anything. I think he just had knowledge of it, but.
Yeah, I mean, well, and that's like something that just popped into my head while you were telling that story is like, I have a lot of sympathy for, like, people like leaders of these like legitimate like leftist, Marxist, whatever resistance groups, because like, I was thinking when you were talking, it's like, okay, yeah, so I'm doing guerrilla warfare. I'm organizing, violent resistance. I need guns. Where do I get guns from? And it's like all that shit is tied up with the like at a high enough level with the forces that I'm trying to fight against. So how can I, like there's all these ways that you could, I mean, this comes back to what we were talking about with intelligence, where it's like it's almost like it. The way that my brain's computing this is like you're in like a boat, like you're in like the boat that Castro and Guevara and all them took to Cuba. Like it's an old boat, it's rickety, and there's all these holes popping up, and you have to have the like you have to have intelligence to know like which holes to patch when, because there's all these different ways people like your enemies are going to try to undermine you. And the Christian David character is like a great example where it's like, yeah, we need guns. This guy's got guns. He sounds charismatic and compelling, and then you end up getting fucked. I mean, he undermines.
It's like the Baader-Meinhof group, where it's like the guy who started things really was a fucking lawyer who had a illicit gun connection, who later turned out to be like probably, an asset of maybe West German intelligence. And then who's going to call him on it? Not the fucking like homeless teens that are joining the Baader-Meinhof gang. Like they don't know anything. So it's at a certain point, it's like you're extremely infiltrated. Like it's fucked.
Yeah, and I just the degree of wariness and like vigilance is just it's got to be unreal. I mean that like we talk about pinching a lot and paranoia, but like that has I that's got to be the central hell of paranoia is being like a third world leftist organizer or resistance leader.
No, it's so true. Like, I wasn't even really going to talk about it too much on this recording, but like I told you I saw that movie. I think it was called 12-year A 12-Year Night on Netflix,
Yeah, out of the Netflix movie.
which focused on like three of the top Tupamaro, one of whom was El Niato, who, I talked about with Comrade Billy. They were basically held hostage by the Uruguayan state to keep the Tupamaros from continuing their war. Because it was like, okay, if you do more actions, we'll kill these guys. And hundreds more, too, which technically works, right? But one of the characters, Pepe Mujica, he freaking started hearing voices in his head, and he believed that they put a fucking chip in his tooth to be able to read his, like, to be able to hear what he was saying and maybe read his thoughts.
Jesus.
And he gets out of prison, it goes away. He becomes the freaking president of Uruguay. He wasn't crazy. They were probably literally doing that, dude.
Jesus.
And that's in the fucking movie. I had no idea that there was like wavy shit with the fucking Tupamaros, dude.
Yeah. I don't even know. It's such a like radical shift in perspective to hear these stories as, you know, fact as opposed to conspiracy or whatever.
Because it's like, who would they be bugging with this technology if not literally
Right.
a Marxist insurgency?
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's paranoia.
Yeah.
Nasty shit.
And so it's just like, come to Program to Chill. We got a history of Marxist insurgencies with the paranoid shit still baked in.
Right. Yeah, I mean, because and like that's I like I've been thinking about it a lot since we I forget when we first started talking about it, but like the important like you know there's all the dickheads on Twitter who are like, why who even cares about the CIA? Who like why what's it matter? It doesn't matter, you know, da da da. Like we need to focus on Bernie or we need to focus on AOC or whatever. And it's like where the rubber hits the road in all these cases, like intelligence is always cr central. It's crucial, right? Like you can, yeah, and like whatever, you know, don't read McGowan. So, I mean, you should read McGowan, but like even setting that aside, like it's like, you know, you have to look at this from a perspective of, you know, it's history, right? It's not conspiracy. It's just, yeah.
Exactly. So we raised the question earlier, why Mitrione, right? And I think we've laid out more than enough reasons for the Tupamaros to target him. And between how well trained they were, their contacts with Cuban intelligence, and honestly also their contacts among Uruguayan, like middle and upper classes and the Uruguayan military, it does not seem impossible for them to like know who to grab, basically.
Right.
But still, why Mitrione? Why did he specifically die? Because can we really chalk it up just to the trajectory of the Tupamaros at the time, and to a lesser extent, the Nixon administration being so intransigent? Or did Mitrione do anything in his past that might have angered anyone on his side? You know?
Yeah, right. Like, did he get burned?
Yeah, because it's like the Tupamaros really didn't want to kill him. They wanted the prisoner exchange.
Right.
And the Nixon administration said no, but I don't think it's not like the fucking Nixon administration had any scruples. They could have just said back channel, do it, whatever, or something. Like,
Right.
ain't, there's so much play there.
Right.
It wasn't a foregone conclusion. So, like, okay, well, Jim Jones hadn't happened yet. People's Temple hadn't happened yet.
Right.
But it would happen in the future. Like, I'm wondering whether he was dirty and he played dirty. And I wonder if there wasn't factions in the US national security state who were fine with him dying.
Right. Like, you know, well, yeah, especially with the Jonestown thing where it's like, I mean, we talked about Jim Jones talking about him on the tapes, You know, it would be to have an opportunity. I think it's probably, it seems a little too noited to be like the whole thing was orchestrated to get him out of the way, but like the opportunity presents itself and you have people saying like, well, I mean, not the worst thing in the world if this guy dies, right? Like, not gonna go out of our way to save him.
Like in the, what was it? Okay, like 1947. How many years is it? Let me bring up the calculator.
47 to 72.
2023 minus
Oh.
1947. Okay, since like speaking of from today, there's the CIA has existed for roughly 75, 76 years. Okay. The CIA Memorial Wall, which is supposed to honor CIA officers who lost their lives while serving their country, the implication being like in the line of duty.
Right.
I mean, I think there, I don't know if it's actually names. I think it might just be like stars or whatever, but like there are 140 instances where it's supposed to be CIA officers who've lost their lives in the, in doing their job, right?
Those are rookie numbers. We gotta pump those numbers up.
So it's an extremely safe job. Almost nobody ever dies because they're a CIA officer. Going off of that, and also just like anecdotal, not anecdotal,
Right.
you know, evidence, right?
Yeah, right.
So what was it about Mitrione that got him killed? Like we said, you know, we're dancing around it, but in maybe a few minutes, I'll revisit that question, but in the short term here, I just wanted to, let me see how much I want to do this. I just wanted to talk a little bit about Condor because you brought up Condor, and I think it would be good to talk about basically what happened on the entire continent.
For sure.
And like, I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but like, there's a certain tendency among like a certain type of leftist who like seeks for liberal approval, so they try to like make it out like the Tupamaros or any given country, Cuba, other insurgencies, like that they were like not, they try to make it out like they're harmless.
Right.
And it's like, okay, well, to a certain extent, what you can condemn from the Uruguayan military and police are the tactics, not that they viewed the Tupamaros or another different group as like an existential threat because they were. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, for sure.
Like the conflict is serious and it's like for the stakes are as high as people in a stadium being killed or disappeared, all right? Like,
Right.
or on the flip side, horror of horrors, having to go to live in Miami. That's the worst case scenario for the other side, but whatever. Okay.
Right.
So basically, there is a like a rewriting of history where they make it seem like there could never have been any other revolutions but the Cuban one in Latin America.
Right.
Or I guess Nicaragua too. But like in reality, many of the countries of Latin America could have gone the way of Cuba, which is to say, having some form of social revolution. So like in Bolivia, there was the ELN, even after Che. There in Chile, there was the MIR. In Argentina, there was the ERP. And of course, in Uruguay, there was the Tupamaros. Now, together, they actually did attempt to create a unified revolutionary organization called the JCR, the Revolutionary Coordinating Junta. And they tried to do this in 1972 and 1973. They were trying to create an infrastructure, like an international Latin American international apparatus to provide mutual logistical, financial, and military support for one another.
Oh, yes.
Sounds pretty base, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Let me just tell you why this didn't work out, okay? Because they had deeper ties to Trotskyism than Orthodox Marxism.
No, God damn, man.
So the MIR, that's the Chilean one, the MIR leader named Miguel Enriquez envisioned the JCR as a fifth international, right? So they were trying to do worldwide revolution before like a socialism in one country approach.
Yeah.
So it's not to say it was all bad, right? It was clearly like needed in Latin America, but like it was also partially trying to be a fulfillment of Che Guevara's vision, because one of Guevara's last speeches in Cuba in 1966, Che recommended that armed groups in Latin America should form something like a JCR to make the repressive work of Yankee imperialism more difficult and to facilitate their own cause. So they were trying to do that. So,
right.
You know, that's cool. So after the failure of Salvador Allende's electoral socialism approach in Chile in the wake of the 1973 coup and the rising tide of fascist death squads in just about every country in Latin America or South America, the JCR was looking more and more like the only possible avenue for left politics in Latin America, right?
Right.
So the JCR planned on launching a military counterattack to the Pinochet coup and to time military offensives in each of the other countries to trigger a wave of internal rebellions and collapses of different regimes.
Nice.
This was a serious fucking operation. They had a operating budget of $20 million.
Wow.
It was mostly funded through the ERPs, kidnappings, and ransoms.
Right.
So the Tupamaros were really focused on building up their infrastructure at that time. And they were probably the most serious because they focused on communication systems of couriers, codes, and dead drops. It's like fucking Pynchon with his mail and shit, dude.
Yeah.
They also needed top quality forged documents, credible front businesses to handle certain transactions and to provide cover jobs. They had to rent or buy hundreds of safe houses and apartments. You know, all of this costs a shit ton of money.
Yeah, right.
So the ERP in Argentina had the largest war chest. The MIR in Chile actually had a full-on secret weapons factory.
That's so sick.
However, perhaps disconcerting, a discordant note, if you will, the JCR put out a magazine, a glossy-ass magazine. Okay. So the JCR wanted to get the approval of and the support of Fidel Castro and just the Cuban government. I mean, he's the big swinging dick in the room, the only guy who's successfully done the thing they all want to do, right?
Right.
So they sent people from the JCR to Cuba. I mean, a lot of them had already either been there and received training, you know, but still, they formally sent a guy named Martinez Platero to go to Cuba and then to Europe. But I mean, in Cuba, they were going to formally ask for his approval and for assistance and so forth.
Right.
So Martinez Platero first went to visit Manuel Pinheiro, also known as Barbarroja or Redbeard. So Redbeard was, since the beginning of the like Cuban Revolution, he was like one of Castro's right-hand men. And he became the spy master for Cuba.
Right.
This guy was a fucking genius. He basically oversaw Cuban intelligence during all of the crucial periods of like Cuban history until like, let me see here. I forget. I didn't write down because I'm going to do an episode on him. Trust me. another Cuban book I had to get overseas. So he basically headed their intelligence service through Pinheiro. That's how hundreds of Tupamaros had already received military training, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Platero met with him. Then he met with Fidel Castro. And Castro reportedly said that he was not against armed struggle, obviously, but he thought that the JCR's plans were impractical and stupid. This is according to a book about Operation Condor, but reportedly he said, "I would like to honor you, but it is because you are a leader of the Tupamaros. I would never receive you as the representative of the JCR. Chico, don't run around with those Trotskyists. It's a waste of time."
Lovely. Like you said, swinging dick. That's right.
From the words of Fidel Castro himself, Chico, don't run around with those Trotskyists. It's a waste of time.
That's beautiful. That's so good.
So Castro disagreed with them because of the Trotskyists, but he also did not take them seriously because they made, in his view, a big strategic error by publicly proclaiming multi-country revolution before proper steps had been taken. So they basically telegraphed their punches. They said, we're going to be doing revolution right now. Heads up.
Right. Yeah. Just the dumbest shit in the world.
Yeah.
Horrible, horrible tactic.
It's not a good strategy.
No. Yeah, that's stupid as fuck.
The JCR thought that this would be a call to action that would draw the masses in to basically be on their side.
That never works. That doesn't work.
Didn't go down like that.
No, that's what Castro did right. Is you got it. It's actions, man. It's always actions. You have to, anyone can say anything, you know, but you show up and you start doing shit. That's how you win hearts and minds.
Listen, you put a sign out that says free beer. Some people might be interested to walk in and see if it's true. You start handing free beer out, everybody's going to come.
Give people beer. Exactly. Yeah, right.
Come on.
They tell all their friends, you know, this dude just gave me a beer. Yeah.
So Castro advised him that the timing of the military offensive would be disastrous and could provoke executions of the already imprisoned, you know, leaders.
Mm-hmm.
Castro told them to focus on building coalitions for the time being. He committed to supporting the Tupamaros specifically, but he would not agree that Cuba would become an operational or training center for the JCR generally. Which, again, probably shows why the JCR fucking, or why the Tupamaros fucking kicked ass and the rest of the orgs just ate shit immediately.
Right.
So, like I said, in November 1974, the JCR proclaimed their existence through a manifesto and that glossy magazine entitled Che Guevara, Junta de Coordinación Revolucionaria. So, immediately, the JCR became the number one target of Operation Condor. One Chilean JCR operative named René Valenzuela said, when we announced the JCR, it was like a campanazo, like ringing a big bell. They, the military governments, thought it was much bigger than it actually was, and they reacted very rapidly with devastating force. We were in diapers, with lots of problems, and never really had the opportunity to do what we set out to do, unquote. Within 2 years, the JCR and many of the constituent groups were completely dismantled or destroyed, with the majority of its members assassinated. They should have listened to Castro, but even if you don't listen to Castro, just maybe you can, like, Sun Tzu Machiavelli your way into deciding that it's not a good strategic move to proclaim a multi-country revolutionary war through a fucking glossy magazine.
Yeah, that is like, yeah. How is that? How does that get past? Like, how do you not say that to somebody and they're like, man, you suck at this? Like, yeah.
It's the epitome of adventurism, for one thing.
Yeah, for real. Jesus.
If it's not some big honeypot in the first place. To right. Fucking, like, sucker a bunch of people into joining an organization that's just immediately going to, like, faceplant.
It literally gets them killed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Much to think about.
Wouldn't be the first time Trotsky gets helped out with the honeypot.
All right, I got one last section here for you. So, one final tangent. In Richmond, Indiana, you can find multiple plaques dedicated to Dan Mitrione. There's one in the rotunda of the Richmond City Building, and it reads, Dan A. Mitrione, former Chief Richmond PD, while serving with the U.S. State Department, U.S. State Department in Uruguay, was kidnapped and brutally murdered by a terrorist gang, 1970. At the City Building, there's another one that reads, Dan A. Mitrione, 10 August 1970, in eternal memory with reverence from the citizens of Uruguay.
Okay, go on.
Now, CJ, you know me. You know my show. I have long maintained that to know a person, you have to know their family.
Yeah.
You have to know. I mean, to a certain extent, I'm sure it's true for kids, but, you know, not everyone has kids. You have to know someone's parents, grandparents, ancestors.
Right.
To know where they're really coming from.
All of history is family history.
Exactly. So, believe it or not, right? I typically don't like to talk that much about these ghouls' kids unless they deserve it. So now I have to talk about Dan Mitrione's kid. And I think that this, I mean, very few people might know this story, but you were not going to fucking believe this, okay?
Yeah.
So, Dan A. Mitrione Jr., one of Dan Mitrione's many kids. I think he had eight, I think I said.
Nine, I think.
Yeah. So, Dan Jr., he was able to go to college thanks to that benefit concert with Sinatra and Jerry Lewis, right? Sucks to be an orphan. I'm not going to say he probably had it easy, although getting to go to college, whatever. Okay. He joins the Marines. He did a tour in Vietnam. He attends the University of Maryland. He majored in the completely not spooky major of international affairs. Then he enters the FBI Academy and becomes an FBI agent.
Oh,
all right. So, according to an article in the Miami Times, in 1972, 2 years after his father's assassination, he joined the FBI. But even as he began what might have seemed a promising career with the Bureau, the agent harbored a disturbing secret. Mitrione, whom other agents found competent if moody and hot-tempered, believed that his father had been murdered by his own government. He joined the FBI for only one reason, to track down his father's killers in the United States State Department and terminate them.
Wow.
Real spy shit.
Wow, what in the world?
Okay, so he fucking joins the FBI in order to kill the people who killed his dad.
That's amazing.
And I'm certain you do not have any clue where this is going to go.
Okay, continue.
Okay. So, in 1982, January 1982, Vice President Bush announced the South Florida Drug Task Force, and it made Miami and Fort Lauderdale the battleground for Reagan's war on drugs. In conjunction with that, Congress passed a new law making it so that the FBI could have jurisdiction over narcotics cases. Previously, they didn't.
Right.
So the South Florida Drug Task Force was launching its first major investigation, and it was called Operation Airlift. And Dan Mitrione Jr. was leading it.
Jesus.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
So Operation Airlift was built around this mobbed up guy named Hilmer Sandini, who had like this long track record of fraud and murder. Sandini and Mitrione worked closely together. And according to this like wild Miami New Times article, it basically says that Mitrione Jr. helped cover up some of Sandini's murders by downplaying his involvement when talking to his FBI higher ups.
Interesting.
But so the whole point of Operation Airlift, though, right? They basically got like Mitrione was doing undercover work before this point, and he basically sets himself up as a drug trafficker.
Right.
And so he and Sandini get an airplane hangar, and they get in contact with some smugglers, literally some Miami Vice shit. And so let's see here. I have a passage from that article, which says, a lot of time and money went down the drain, and Dan seemed to be very disappointed and turned real sour on the whole deal, Sandini later wrote. It was at this point that Dan really changed. He had severe moods of depression and cursed Washington for having people that knew absolutely nothing about the drug business and nothing about working undercover. Shortly after the turndown, he helped me understand that from this point, he wanted in on the big money. Sandini wrote that Mitrione told him the only reason he was with the Bureau was to find out who had killed his father or ordered the killing. Dan asked me to secure several guns with silencers, including a machine gun, adding that Mitrione had assembled an unofficial assassination squad of friends who would kill his father's murderers. Operation Airlift, born of murder, hidden motives, and lies, was about to take off, and Mitrione would soon discover what the big money was all about. Unquote. So, Sandini and Mitrione sent smugglers, like representatives, to meet the Ochoa brothers, who were like the next biggest guys next to Escobar.
Wow.
They had a contact in Colombia, a guy named Luis Bernardo Sanchez Castro, who was a retired colonel in the Colombian Air Force. Sanchez went by the alias Hernando, and Hernando was, I mean, it's the same guy. He was so high up that when George H.W. Bush came to visit Colombia in the 1980s, he was his liaison.
Jesus.
Bush came in order to, he came during a fact-finding mission about cocaine production in Colombia. Do you think that Bush ever got to the bottom of that?
Well, I mean, I think it's easy to make Bush like a bad guy, like the bad guy of the 20th century, but like he kind of is, you know what I mean? Like he really,
if you had to pick one, I mean, Dulles is dead, so.
Yeah. I did not know that. That doesn't show up in Family of Secrets.
No, it's not in Family of Secrets. Interesting.
Huh. Weird how that goes. That's wild though.
So during this whole time undercover, Mitrione Jr. never wore a wire, and he would not let the FBI bug the hangar, which you think would be like a non-starter. You'd think the FBI would be like,
right.
No, we're fucking bugging the hangar.
What are you talking about? Right.
Nope. And I quote again from the article. In January 1983, almost a year after airlift began, then agent Christopher Mazzelli, now Miami-Dade County Inspector General, reviewed the Operation Airlift file and found that it was in shambles, according to reports. Word reached Mitrione that headquarters was talking about shutting the operation down. On March 5th, 1983, he and Sandini made a bold move to appease the FBI brass. They stole 200 kilos of cocaine from a cocaine shipment in Memphis and delivered it to authorities as proof they were getting the job done. The Bureau gave the cocaine to the Fort Lauderdale Police Department, which made it the largest seizure of the drug in that agency's history. It was the top news story for the day in Broward County, and the chief posed for pictures of the bricks and everything, and they concocted a story about how the department drug dog sniffed out the cocaine in a Fort Lauderdale parking lot.
That's so good. That, man.
You could not believe this shit, dude.
That's it. They stole it from a Memphis deal?
Mm-hmm.
Just to justify, like, oh my god. That's...
Because they're not going to rip off their own guys, obviously.
Right, of course, right. That is just wild. Between drugs and oil, that's it. That's all. At the end of the, at the bottom of everything, there's the drug trade and oil, and that's...
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
So what the FBI wouldn't learn until much later was that Sandini and Mitrione stole 42 kilos for themselves before handing the cocaine over to the Bureau.
Oh.
A skim that netted the agent and his informant about $1 million each. The seized shipment, however, was not enough to save Operation Airlift. Mm-hmm. On April 20th, 4/20, 1983, The FBI terminated the operation. 2 months later, Mitrione Jr. resigned to become a business partner with Sandini, who kept the drug smuggling operation going. Soon, Mitrione was buying boats, property, cars. He took his wife, Janet, on long vacations to Yellowstone, Rio de Janeiro, a family location. He probably lived in Rio when he was a kid, and London. Sandini stashed millions in offshore bank accounts in the Cayman Islands, and the greatest law enforcement agency in the world still apparently had no clue that its agent had gone astray, unquote.
Oh, wow.
So if the New York Times article is, or Miami New Times article is to be believed, Mitrione Jr. stayed in the life and kept trafficking drugs, and eventually a DEA investigation happened across him. And as these things often happen, they're like, wait, isn't he FBI? And they're like, wait a minute, he doesn't work for the FBI anymore. Wait a minute, what's this guy doing?
Right.
And so around the same time, basically, Mitrione and Sandini started to turn on each other, and it got so bad that basically it's pretty certain that Mitrione Jr. probably put a car bomb under Sandini's car and almost killed him.
Oh.
I don't know. Did he go to Los Fresnos to learn how to make a car bomb?
Yeah, right.
So under pressure and knowing he might be arrested or killed, Mitrione Jr. almost committed suicide and then checked himself into a mental hospital. And folks, I think it's important, like, mental health is no joke. You know, you need help, you should get it. It's not a stigma, okay? You need to, like, go out. If you need help, you should get it.
Right. The resources are out there. But I would like to follow that up by saying, if you are related to Dan Mitrione, you should just kill yourself. Simple as. That's the best way you can treat that. It's a disorder that doesn't go away.
Statistically, most of his kids are probably fine. But if you're trafficking drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ultimately, Mitrione Jr. would never be prosecuted for the car bomb because the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office kind of hid information because they were focused on getting him off the streets, which they did. Because instead of the car bomb, they basically arrested him and made him plead guilty to narcotics and bribery charges. This was in March 1985, and I would like to read from a New York Times article entitled "Ex-FBI Agent Cooperates in Drug Inquiry After Guilty Plea." The former federal agent who pleaded guilty to drug-related charges Thursday is continuing to cooperate with authorities in an investigation of a large drug ring, federal authorities said today. The authorities said the former agent of the FBI, Dan A. Mitrione Jr., was cooperating as part of a plea bargain. He was charged with only 3 counts, possession of cocaine and conspiracy to distribute it, and taking bribes. And his sentencing was temporarily deferred. He was also turned over. Mr. Mitrione also turned over to the federal government money, real estate, and other property with an estimated value of $850,000 that he acquired selling cocaine. Mr. Mitrione, who pleaded guilty in federal court, was said by a bureau spokesman in Washington to be the first agent known to have been involved in drug trafficking while in active service. Even the FBI director, William H. Webster, weighed in, saying, "The corrupting power of drug money is one of the most obvious reasons why this number one crime problem must be conquered in our country. It must be exposed and rooted out wherever it may be found. This sad case illustrates our relentless determination to police our ranks."
Wow. That's the commitment to just ending drugs and drug usage. That's really noble. Really. I don't think much.
And it shows that they police themselves. There's a healing mechanism that, like, if someone goes rogue, they'll catch them.
Okay? Yeah, exactly. Every time. It's a system that works.
So Mitrione Jr., he trafficked drugs from Panama and Colombia to Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Pittsburgh, to his own home state of Indiana, and to, ding, 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 Memphis, Tennessee, the Dirty South, right?
Mm-hmm.
One of the agents who actually worked on the case against Mitrione Jr. was a guy named Frank Buttino, Buttino. He's freaking Italians. So Buttino got a commendation and a cash award for his work on against Operation Airlift. Buttino later wrote a book entitled A Special Agent, Gay and Inside the FBI.
Wow.
He was one of the first FBI agents to be openly gay.
And we're recording this right after Pride Month ended.
I mean, obviously, it's, you know, in the spirit of the FBI in terms of Hoover and so forth, but...
Yeah, Hoover and all that, right.
In the book, though, Buttino writes that the FBI had a policy of blackmailing gay men into resigning. Very interesting.
Wow.
I guess that's how they used to handle it. So it is wild to me that the Dan A. Mitrione Jr. story is not a bigger story, because it's like Miami Vice. It's like the FBI Whitey Bulger story, but like crazier.
Yeah, that's crazy.
That's fucking wild.
So Mitrione Jr. would be sentenced to 6 years, and he served 3 for good behavior.
Nice.
CJ, do you think Mitrione Jr. ever tracked down his father's killers in the State Department and got revenge?
No, I'm gonna go no.
In that case, do you think the rival faction of the deep state took him out before he could?
That's it. You know, that's interesting that you put it like that. You know, and trouble in paradise. When I'm here, trouble in paradise.
Here's my theory. I think Dan Mitrione Jr. was perhaps genetically gifted at lying to himself and justifying his sins, because that's what his father did. Listeners, I'm not God. You decide. But if I were a betting man, I am willing to bet that it's a case of like father, like son.
Yeah. No, I my gut, based on the story as you just told it, is that, you know, you don't steal 42 kilos of cocaine without wanting the money. There's not a noble, like, I'm trying to find my father. You know, this isn't the fucking the Man in Black, or not the Man in Black, Inigo Montoya from The Prince of Pride. You know what I mean? He's a common criminal.
Yeah, no, it's like, that sounds very much like how spies, whenever they get caught doing something, or frequently, they will claim some that somehow they got burned by some faction inside the agency. Yeah. It's like actually really common for like claims like that to happen. I don't know. I think probably he just was a dirty, dirty cop. And
yeah,
I don't see any reason to think that, like, I don't even really think Mitrione Sr. was killed for any good reason other than he was guilty and he got unlucky and Nixon said no.
Yeah, no, I think that going to another scenario is kind of like taking away some of the righteousness and the power. Like, I think the two Mars was good at what they did. You know what I mean? And and then the Mitrione Jr. shit, it sounds more like Walter White.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where like he's like, well, I'm just doing this for my family, as he's running like the drug trade in New Mexico, you know. And it's like, you could have stopped a long time ago, dude. Like,
you
know,
you got enough money to like for your cancer treatment, like, you could have stopped.
Exactly, right. Yeah, no, wild shit.
So yeah, things went in a few directions I was not anticipating, but in conclusion, Tupamaros good, Mitrione family bad.
Yep.
OPS bad, CIA bad. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of takeaways. Torture and death squads bad.
Yep.
Trotskyists, as ever, bad.
Mm-hmm.
Castro, good.
Mm-hmm.
Bolaño, good. Read Bolaño.
Costa Gavras, good.
Watch Costa Gavras movies, read Bolaño. I wonder if anyone, because one of the first times I came on the show, I told everyone to read the Book of Mormon. I wonder if anybody did.
If they did, they never told me about it, which means it probably didn't happen.
There was somebody on Patreon. I'm glad this popped into my head, because I'm gonna plug it now. There was somebody on Patreon who commented on a post. Mm-hmm. I think you we talked about this before, but it was like, It was after I was talking about the Eastern Europeans and Scientology here in Pinellas County. And on one of the comments on your Patreon upload was like, you know, CJ is exactly right about this, da da da. Also, I think I know him. I grew up in Pinellas County. So if you're listening, whoever you were, I replied to your post on Patreon, but I want for you to DM me on Twitter because I want to know the other Program to Chill listener in Pinellas County outside of me and the Mind Games boys.
Yeah.
Because that blew my mind.
That's wild. And that's so, and then they never did get in contact, as far as you
Yeah,
know.
no, I'm gonna pull it up right now because this is like I'm not like doing any doxing or anything. This is public. This is a public post. I'm gonna have to go back for a second. Hang on. This was under what? Do you remember when you
The
published the?
Necronomicon one?
Yes. Here.
It
Yep. Got
was a
it right here.
while. Oh, you found it fast.
All right. So 20 comments. Gonna go. Ba, ba, ba. You can cut this like, yeah. RD posted August 31st, 2022 at 1:26. The middle section of this episode hit me because I also live in St. Pete, Clearwater area, and I'm pretty sure I know Dr. Pig, LMFAO. Everything he said is true, and there's much more to Scientology's hold on the Tampa Bay area. Could be a whole episode. To which I replied, "Yo, DM me on Twitter again, RD. I'm dying to know who you are." But no pressure also too, and whatever. But that is funny. So yeah, read the Book of Mormon, read Bolaño, watch Costa Gavras movies. If you're already DM me on Twitter. Get off of Twitter though, all of you. I think we started.
Yeah.
Don't. Yeah, save yourselves. It's better.
Life can be so much better.
Yeah. Well, in all seriousness, because like, you know, you spend so much time posting and talking about this shit, and it's like it doesn't need that much of your brain. Like it starts to, I think, be kind of counterproductive. Like I feel better. Am I like reading every single unhinged theory? And like I don't say that like without love. Like I mean a lot of the stuff is unhinged because it is the content is unhinged, not the suggestion that it's true, right? But like there is more distance, you know, I think. Spend less time on Twitter.
Yeah, no, it's nice to like meet cool people online, but
For sure.
the Doom Scroll, it's no bueno.
No, and you can, yeah, I'm reading better, which is huge. I couldn't, like, I had the hardest time reading books when I was spending a lot of time on Twitter, and now it's much easier. I was also, you know, like miserable for personal reasons, and that probably didn't help. But yeah, also, you know, make your life better, make positive,
Yeah.
you know. But yeah, this has been really good. I think this is another successful episode.
Definitely. I was just gonna, yeah, hit the stop record.
Okay.
Unless, yeah, do you have anything you'd like to say?
I should say
Nothing
it.
to plug either, really, right?
Yeah, Mind Games will make a return someday, but
Yeah.
go on an indefinite hiatus. I just want to say adios now that I'm learning Spanish.
They're breaking into the broadcast. special update from Action News. Some of what you'll hear in the footage that follows may not reflect our station's view. We may run out of bullets. We're never gonna run out of hostages. There's disagreements on procedure. Vocal bitter divisions. As is often the case in situations like this one, I'll be the one who makes the final decision. Some of you have been here before, most of you have not. Some will dwell on the details in the future, or work to keep it out of your thoughts. We may run out of bullets. We're never gonna run out of hostages. If there's one thing I love, it's an infinite resource. If there's one thing worth loving, it's a surplus of supplies. To the team. When you know you'll never make it out alive, you kind of get to live out.